Now, when it comes to Atlantis hunters or alternate historians or whatever label you want to throw on us today, one thing we're always looking for is signs of higher technology in the distant past. And personally, when I say higher technology, I don't mean alien stuff or computers or lasers or any of that. I'm talking about anything that most ancient people would look at and been like, whoa, this is magical. This is something that God's brought us. Astronomy, math, building, sailing. You know, even pottery could potentially fit the definition of higher technology depending on the time and place. There's all manner of things that could be mistaken as magic or the like, and once a technique is lost, myths may well remember these things in a mystical light. One example of this would be the copper artifacts that the Native Americans that lived near the Great Lakes were making as far back as 9,500 years ago that we know for sure, probably further back than that. Knives, spear tips, scrapers, needles, fish hooks, jewelry, and even a big old blade that's basically a sword. The copper artifacts that these people made were so plentiful that you can still find them in the region laying under just a few inches of topsoil. But by the time the Europeans were settling America, the natives had quit mining copper and really barely worked it anymore. Indeed, only a few hooks, needles, and pieces of jewelry remained in use. The copper weapon and tool making had long ceased to be a thing. Why would be the obvious question, which is something we're going to answer in this video. We're not only going to go through a big chunk of the mainstream archaeological and historical knowledge that we have about the old copper culture, we're also going to look at one of the largest alternate theories surrounding them. Did a lot of the copper that they mine end up in the old world? Was there contact between the old copper culture and the Minoans, for example? Well, sit yourself down. It'd be a little bit longer video than normal. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. Known to archaeologists as the Old Copper Complex, the name is basically a catch-all for the copper-using people clustered around the Great Lakes, most notably Lake Superior. Scattered over time from 9,500 years ago till about 3,000 years ago, these people used copper thousands of years before anyone else was. There is one important fact that changes the optics on this anomaly quite a bit. The copper that comes out of the ground there comes out in very large chunks and is very, very pure. Known as native copper, it is often 99.9% copper, far exceeding the purity in every other known deposit on the planet. How it got there is a little bit of a geological mystery, but one of the more reasonable ideas is the continent was in turmoil during the formation of the Appalachian Mountains. The region near Lake Superior opened up and partially exposed the copper during volcanic activity, with glaciers scraping the ground and making much more, basically pure copper, readily available to the first humans to chance upon it, which, according to archaeology, happened at least 9,500 years ago. And what they would have seen was huge chunks of copper, often as large as a man or even a car, just laying there for the taking. Yes, a car. In 1997, a 26-ton chunk of copper was pulled out of Lake Superior. It's the largest known copper nugget, or whatever you want to call it, in existence today. Now, this was pure, ready-to-work pieces of copper of all manner of sizes just littered the area. So pure, in fact, the Native Americans didn't need to smelt the copper to use it. A skilled craftsman could heat it up enough to make it soft enough to shape, and that was all they would need to do to make tools and trinkets. Now, this allowed them to make copper tools with very low-tech means, and obviously this facilitated the use of copper. But it also limited the metal as well. Smelting is a process in which ore is heated, the desired metal is melted, and other impurities removed. Trace elements have always been an issue. The fuel from the heat source can introduce carbon, and of course the ore generally is not pure. Now, when you're smelting metal, impurities are usually problematic, but sometimes they can be beneficial. Steel is made of iron and carbon, and it's said that in the Middle Ages, blacksmiths noticed that when they used furnaces with lots of coal, the iron that they made came out harder and more durable. That's because the carbon in the coal got into the iron. Nowadays, of course, chemists and metallurgists and engineers design the alloys from the ground up, on paper first in the lab, but before it was a science, happy little accidents made metal better. In my video covering the iron plate found in the Great Pyramid, I discuss early iron smelting in Bronze Age Turkey and how the random impurities made some iron better for tools and some of it was really only fit for ceremonial purposes. Link is in the description if you're interested, but my point here is not having to smelt metals is both a hurdle and a boon. Cultures that have to make fires hot enough to smelt metal and separate it from ore will end up inadvertently making alloys, and over time they will figure out ways to remove the impurities from the metals that they don't want and only introduce the ones that they do want in the proper amounts. But in the case of the old copper culture, they didn't have to smelt. They had basically pure copper to work with, and it just needed heated up a little bit by comparison to be workable, to be something they could shape. And as a result, they never introduced impurities to their copper. Bronze is a little tin added to your copper. And we don't remember a copper age, but we do remember a bronze age, because bronze is much harder and more durable than copper. Copper worked, but stone is harder, sharper, and more readily available, in most places anyway. And in the Lake Superior region, copper was at least as abundant as good stone for tool making, so it was used, obviously never smelted, but shaped. Now, this limited the size of objects that they could make from the copper. They can't melt down a bunch of small pieces into one big piece, so they take a big piece, and that's as big as their item that they can make from this will ever be. So larger chunks of native copper were probably far more valuable than an equal amount of smaller pieces. This means that when an artifact broke, they couldn't forge it back together. They had to use the pieces of copper that it broke into to make new things. And they were always smaller than it was before, right? So by the time the Europeans showed up, the people that were descendants of the old copper complex were using needles and fish hooks and beads and small copper things, because over time things had gotten a lot smaller. But why had they quit mining fresh copper? Why weren't they using that stuff anymore? Why had they reverted to stone again? Well, basically, the easily obtained native copper deposits were long gone. They had mines all over the Lake Superior region, with the largest concentration that we know of today being located on Isle Royale. Consisting of shallow pits that go no more than about 30 feet down, these mines were just holes looking for more of those pure copper nuggets. The level of organization of this mining is debated by scholars. Some of them believe that it was a very organized expedition. Every year they would send people out there to mine copper. Others believe that it was just part of a normal migratory hunting path. You just pop in there and grab some copper while you're doing whatever. Hierarchy can help us here. The graves of copper culture people tend to be very similar in regards to their care and their grave goods. It seems that their culture is less hierarchical than many others, so organized copper mining trips may have been less common. What is certain is hundreds of these pits exist, and they are mines. The first Europeans that came to that area to mine copper noticed that many of those pits still had the mining tools inside of them from thousands and thousands of years ago. And we can presume, based on the size of the copper that we're pulling out of there in the modern day, that 10,000, 9,000, 5,000 years ago, they had to have been pulling out some absolutely massive chunks. And there is testimony of this all over the area in the form of artifacts that are just a couple inches under the topsoil. It's difficult to even guess how many artifacts were made by the old copper complex. In the early 20th century, a Wisconsin lawyer named P.V. Lawson created the most complete catalog of these copper artifacts, and he estimated the total to be around 13,000. Now, over 100 years later, the estimate's around 20,000, maybe more. The issue is the enthusiasm of the treasure hunters, people looking for these over the years. Locals in the region often have several pieces that their family have found over the decades. And in the early 1970s, with the release of the Mini Hunter metal detector, interested individuals could afford a metal detector for the first time. Of course I'm going to tell you which metal detector was first. Look at the shells, man. I love old electronics. By the mid-80s, metal detectors were all over the USA, and this gave the copper hunters in the Great Lakes region a tool that allowed them to find things that were long lost to time and were not easy to find up until then. Now, many collections have been donated to museums and universities, but many artifacts remain unaccounted for. Sadly, we can assume the best, the most impressive, are probably unknown to academia and most interested amateurs. In my opinion, they're probably in private hands. At any rate, as the copper deposits ran out, the artifacts were no longer being made, and then copper became a status symbol. It may have been a status symbol before, but by the time the first Europeans met with the descendants of the old copper culture, the only thing that was still actually being used as tools was, like I mentioned earlier, fish hooks and needles. And the fact that they were using these may actually inform us as to why they chose copper over stone, when the stone tools were generally superior. Copper is malleable. One of the most sensible reasons that I've heard that a choice to use copper was made is the ease of shaping copper. It's easy to bend and fold over on itself when heated, and while this means projectile points bend and become dull quickly, it also means fish hooks and needles are easy to form. Look at the stone fish hooks used by the Native Americans and the copper ones side by side, and this really just tells the story plainly. The ability to bend the copper made it superior for some uses, and in my opinion, this is why it was used alongside stone. Tools could be formed into any shape desired and much thinner than stone would allow. Now, this doesn't explain why we see a copper sword in the record, but it does explain why copper was being used. As an aside, can you imagine a Native American running around with a big copper sword? I mean, this sounds like something out of Fortnite, man. It sounds like some Universes Beyond set from Magic the Gathering. Now, there's a hypothesis in the alternate history community that claims the Minoans and Old Copper Complex were engaged in trade, and the large amounts of readily available, pure copper helped drive the Bronze Age. The evidence for this claim is supposedly the amount of copper estimated to have been extracted from the Great Lakes region during the Bronze Age, the amount of copper estimated to have come from the Old World mines, the Old Copper Culture ending its mining around the same time the Minoan civilization collapsed, similar tools and pottery, genetic evidence of contact between cultures, and copper found in Old World shipwrecks like the Uluburun and the Cape Gelidonia shipwrecks. Now, as regular viewers will be well aware, I tend to be skeptical of pretty much anybody's claims in this community. It seems that the true believers and the debunkers both just kind of run whichever direction they want to. Not everybody, but by and large. So let's unravel this on our own and see what we got here. Well, the first thing to mention is one of the noteworthy things of the Old Copper Complex is that it did not use pottery. So the idea that the Minoan style of pottery can be found in their record is simply not true. This kind of thing sadly happens way too much. Somebody says something that tickles somebody else's confirmation bias, so they repeat it without fact-checking it, and the falsehood spreads all over the place. And this happens on both sides of this debate, as we'll see here in a minute. It is true that Minoans used grooved hammer stones, and these are very similar to the tools used by the Lake Superior copper people of the time, so this claim is true. Now, it is worth mentioning that grooved hammer stones are not unique to these two cultures. In fact, it is a very common type of stone tool, so this similarity is not terribly compelling to me personally. The estimated time of the end of the mining of the Lake Superior region is said to have been about 5,000 years ago, long before the Minoan civilization ended. Some estimates say the end of the time of them producing copper tools on a large scale ended around 1600 BC, which would line up with the start of the collapse of the Minoans. So this claim does have some truth to it, but again, not the most compelling in my opinion. Now, as for the estimates of the amount of copper mined at Lake Superior and the amount known to exist, this is where it gets tricky. The estimates vary greatly as to how much copper would have been extracted, and the same is true for how many of the copper artifacts were made by the natives and that are in private hands today and uncatalogued. No one can tell you for sure or even give you an idea how close their estimation is to being accurate. The fact is, we simply do not know how much copper they took out of the ground, and we don't know how much they made into artifacts, and we don't know how many are in private hands. And this logic also applies to the amount of copper said to have been available in the Old World mines. We simply have no good way of even guessing how much copper they had available to mine. I mean, there's big holes in the ground where the evidence would be. All we can do is estimate based on the surrounding area and assume more copper existed in the mines. How much more? Who knows? One thing that is for certain, copper was very valuable during the Bronze Age. So if the Minoans were aware that there was a source of really pure copper, they would probably try to get their butts over there. As for the DNA evidence, this refers to the anomalous haplogroup X. Present in some Old World people and in some Native American peoples without a clear causal link, this is actually compelling information to me. There is no good explanation for the existence of this genetic marker in the Americas unless one assumes there was some sort of contact between the Old and New Worlds. One hypothesis claims the genetic marker came over on the Bering Land Bridge, and the purported evidence for this is the existence of the haplogroup X in northern tribes of Native Americans for the most part. In fact, way up north here in Washington State, we have the Yakima tribe that has the haplogroup X, and they're about an hour drive from me. But the Bering Land Bridge hypothesis isn't fully accepted, as the marker shows up sporadically, not in a clear pattern that we can map out neatly. And two of the tribes with the marker, the Ojibwa and the Chippewa, are located in the right area to be directly descended from the Old Copper culture. The Ojibwa in particular are thought to be descendants of the copper mining natives from millennia ago. So to me, this evidence is pretty robust. We don't have a good explanation for why that genetic marker exists in the Americas, and it exists in the right place. Which leaves us the last bit of evidence claimed to support the Minoan Lake Superior copper connection, the Bronze Age shipwrecks in the Mediterranean that have copper in them. Now, the copper is usually extremely pure, and this is one reason that people assume that the copper came from the native copper deposits around Lake Superior. But the fact is, Bronze Age smelting could get copper to about 99% purity as well, so testing purity alone is not a good way to determine if the copper came from Lake Superior or from a Bronze Age smelter. Now, purity is something that we see in the copper and the Bronze Age oxide ingots. Oxide ingots being the term used to describe the normal form of bar used to transport bulk copper in the Bronze Age Mediterranean trade routes. It's called this due to the odd corners causing the bars to resemble animal hides. Now, without being able to use purity to determine where these came from, we're left with isotopes, and this is where things start to get a little fishy. The Ulleburn shipwreck is the one that is most spoken of here, and I see why. The copper is in two different types of oxide ingot, one type with different corners than the other. Out of the 354 found, 31 of them have only two protrusions on their corners, while the others have the four elongated corners like most of them do. In addition to this, when lead isotopes in the copper was examined, while it was claimed that most came from Cyprus, it is said that the mine was undiscovered, but probably in the northwestern portion of Cyprus. Now, the fact that isotopic analysis was performed on these ingots and that it proved that they came from Cyprus is something that I see cited regularly. However, when I try to access the lead isotope papers, I find something a little odd. All of them are behind paywalls, and that in itself isn't entirely odd, but they are referenced without being cited. Let me say that again. They get referenced without being cited. Even Wikipedia, which as much as I dislike it, at least it usually gives either references for all the factual claims, or it puts a disclaimer at the top of the page saying, hey man, this thing needs some more work. It says this of the Ulleburn shipwreck copper. Lead isotope analysis indicates most or all the copper is sourced in Cyprus. With no reference at all on the oddly vague claim of most of. I mean, if they've analyzed these ingots, couldn't they say where they came from, the most of? Come on now. The next paragraph shows a lead isotope analysis for tin, and it has citations. Now, this is frustrating. We get things like Wikipedia that don't actually reference something but talk like they are, and then they present the stuff to the public in a slipshod manner. It makes it very difficult for us to, you know, actually know what the heck is going on here. And the papers are $50 a piece, man. There's two of them. And I don't really want to spend $100 every time I go to make a video. I'm not making enough money off of this stuff just yet to do that. Soon. But this is an issue I often run into when examining these type of claims. The evidence I find more interesting is often the hardest to access. In this case, I must assume their analysis is less than conclusive, as the details we read online are sparse and somewhat conflicting, with archaeologist Semmel Pollock saying, lead isotope analysis of the Ulleburn oxide ingots shows that they form a relatively homogeneous Cypriot group and were probably derived from a hitherto undiscovered deposit, almost certainly among the Solia Axis ores of northwestern Cyprus, which includes the Opliki deposits. Wikipedia says most, or maybe all, was sourced in Cyprus, and this guy says it's a relatively homogeneous group that was from some undiscovered mine that was certainly in Cyprus. Again, I would really like to see these papers. All too often, I run into these sorts of walls doing research, but this time, I would like to see more work done, and the work that's already been done. The manner that it is reported on currently is suspicious, to say the least, and it leads me to think that there may well be some credence to the idea the old copper complex and the Minoans traded. Which wouldn't be insane, to be honest. The Minoan vessels were capable of long voyages, and were so well made that there are numerous studies on their design and advancement over time. And copper was extremely valuable in the Bronze Age. We also have precedent. There's another European culture that made contact with the Native Americans and traded with them long before Columbus got here. The Vikings. We find Norse goods in the hands of Inuits who lived long ago. Iron goods, metal that was more valuable to the Native Americans than it was to the Norsemen. The fact of the matter is, if the Minoans were aware of such a pure source of copper that was not part of the Bronze Age trade system and therefore presumably much cheaper, they almost certainly would have tried to procure it, even if it meant traveling to the ends of the earth. The genetic evidence is the most robust in my opinion, but the logic is sound. Minoans had vessels capable of the voyage and the desire to go, if they knew it was worth their time. And then we have the funny little coincidence that Plato just happened to mention the vast continent across the Atlantic Ocean. Almost like the learned people of the Bronze Age Mediterranean were well aware of the Americas. One more point in regard to lost civilizations and Atlantis and all that sort of thing. If a culture had copper deposits like this and they ran out, forcing the people to revert to stone, wouldn't it be feasible the people who used copper would be remembered as being from a superior culture? I mean, after all, a group of people with access to a substance you can't even fathom is kind of awe-inspiring, right? One only needs to look to the manner in which the cargo cults of the Pacific Islands reacted to U.S. military contact. In World War II, these islands were valuable as places to make airstrips, makeshift runways, and refueling centers for combat aircraft. The GIs traded with the natives, giving them blankets and knives and other goods. As the natives had no access to finely woven cloth or metal, knives and blankets made by Americans were pretty valuable to them. And after the war, contact between the U.S. military and these islands ceased. But in the 1960s, when anthropologists started going to these islands, they were surprised to find that there was a religion built up around a mythical American soldier. John Fromm is his name, and even though he never existed, he was said to be the giver of the goods and the eventual savior of these people. I mean, the locals constructed all manner of bamboo effigies of technology, and this religion took off in 20 years. Now, it seems quite possible to me that the old copper culture itself could have been remembered in a similar light. And maybe there were other human cultures throughout history that had access to really pure metal for a short period of time, and then thousands of years later, they're remembered as people that were way up here, and now they're way down there. Tough to say for sure. One thing is cool, the old copper culture is definitely an anomaly, and it definitely just doesn't quite fit with my brain still with all the stuff that I know about the Americas and human history. It just seems out of place. And one more thing before I go, this December 5th through 7th, meet me in Scottsdale, Arizona for the Quest for Ancient Civilizations Conference. I'll be there, Jimmy Corsetti will be there, Hugh Newman, Gary, Mike, even Randall Carlson's going to be there. So get your tickets down below. Thank you very much. Don't forget to support the channel, and we'll see you next time.